And I'd like to start out just by saying that that ID seems to have kind of seeped into the general culture. It's no longer just talked about in narrow circles, and that people have definite opinions about it. Here we got a cartoon, you divide people into the smokers and non-smokers and the pro-Darwinists and the pro-intelligent design folks. So people can have, strong feelings about it. So one of the first things I do in my talks is to make sure that everybody knows that I'm speaking for myself and that I'm not talking, I'm not representing Lehigh University or my parents or they... They all have their own opinions about this. I'm just giving you my take on all these matters. So my talk tonight is going to be a summary of what is the argument for intelligent design in biology. You can make arguments for intelligent design in lots of different fields, in physics and in the topic of the mind and so on. Mind is going to be the argument for intelligent design in biology. And as I'm sure most people are aware, the topic of intelligent design has gotten a whole lot of press in the past year or so. Heck, I first wrote on this topic more than 10 years ago, and all of a sudden, it bubbled up to the surface just over the past year or so. President Bush made comments on it. The Pope made comments on intelligent design a month or so ago. So it's become hot. But it's not only being talked about in the popular media. Over the past few years, gotten a lot less attention. But there have been a number of scholarly publications put out, too, by people defending and intelligent design and attacking it. Here's a good book called God and Design, which is edited by a guy named Neil Manson, who's a philosopher of science, put out by Routledge Press, an academic press, in which people, we have academics arguing traditional arguments for the existence of God and design, including design in biology, and other people arguing against them. A book put out a year or so ago by the University of Michigan Press looks at some of the public policy implications of intelligent design, Darwinism, design, and public education. But I think perhaps the best book that has come out recently for people who really want to know the nitty-gritty and want to get up to speed on all sides of this controversial issue. Okay. Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's right. this is a book, Debating Design, put out by Cambridge University Press, which has spokesmen for Darwinist evolution, for theistic evolution, for intelligent design, for something called complexity theory, all arguing their own positions, all arguing against each other. It's a great place for somebody who wants to know the various ins and outs of these issues to get up to speed. But tonight, I'm just going to kind of give you my version of the argument for intelligent design, which I kind of laid out in brief format in an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times February of last year, about a year ago. It actually wasn't on the front page. This is the magic of computer design these days. Should have been. That's what my wife told me. It should have been. But it wasn't. And in it, I said that the argument for design had the following points. The first point is that design is not some mystical conclusion. It's not something you have to close your eyes and hold up your hands to see. It's pretty mundane. And it's deduced simply from the physical structure of a system. The second point of the argument is that everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear to be designed. And by everyone, I mean including the ones who are most opposed to the idea of intelligent design. Nonetheless, those people say that they have a different explanation for the appearance of design in biology. And what I want to argue tonight is that, in fact, there are structural obstacles to that other explanation, to Darwinian evolution, that makes it a very implausible explanation for the appearance of design. Additionally, I want to show you that the grand Darwinian claims for design, for the ability to explain the appearance of design, rest on undisciplined imagination. Okay, so that in fact the claims that Darwinian evolution can explain design are urban legends. And so the conclusion then of the argument, the bottom line, is that we have strong evidence for design and very little evidence that any other non-design explanation can account for it. Okay, so let's start out then with the first point of the argument, that design is not mystical. It's deduced from the physical structure of a system. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, what is design? Well, if you look around, a definition of design, there are a number of different definitions, but one definition of design is the purposeful or inventive arrangement of parts or details. In other words, simply, design is the purposeful arrangement of parts. And that means that we infer design, or we conclude that there has been design, whenever parts appear arranged to accomplish a function or accomplish a purpose. Well, with a lot of this stuff, it's easier to see examples than to look at definitions. So let's look at the following picture. Okay. This is a pile of Legos. Okay, for those of you who don't have kids of a certain age, you might need the information. But this is a pile of Legos. And here's another pile of Legos. Now, what's the difference between the first pile and the second pile? Well, we can tell that this pile of Legos has been arranged on purpose. It looks like somebody put it that way. And if we find out that, in fact, it works as a gun, which it does, we would be confident in saying this was not just some jumbled pile. Somebody arranged it that way. So design is the purposeful arrangement of parts, and we infer design whenever we see parts that have been arranged for a purpose. Here's another pile of Legos. And if you look, it turns out that a lot of the parts are similar to the parts that were in the last designed Lego machine. And the point I want to make here is that even if you use the same parts over and over and over again, and you arrange them in different ways, you can still tell that it was designed. You don't have to have a new part for each new arrangement. You infer the design from how the parts are arranged. Okay. But now another important point about intelligent design is that the strength of the inference is quantitative. That means we can be less sure that something was designed. We can be pretty suspicious that something was designed. We can be really certain, and we can be absolutely certain. It depends on how many parts, how specifically they've been arranged, determines the strength of our conclusion. For example, suppose you were walking along with a friend, and you looked over at these mountains, and the friend said, how do you think those mountains got to be that way? And you would say, well, I don't know. I never did take that geology course in college. Plate tectonics, you know, volcanic activity, erosion. And then he'd say, well, yeah, but, you know, look at that peak right there. Look, it's about 30 feet higher than that peak there. And what's more, this peak here is, you know, a little bit broader than it is over here. And you say, so what? It's got to look like something. You know, why not like that? So you know, plate tectonics and unintelligent forces would seem to be perfectly fine explanations for that. But suppose you were walking by this mountain, okay? Now, I suppose you guys have heard of it since it's in neighboring state. It's called the Old Man of the Mountain. I hear it fell down, sadly.
The forehead of the mountain.
How sad. But suppose these people weren't actually on it. I think these are repairmen trying to shore it up. Didn't do the trick. You'd look and you say, and your friend asked you the same thing. How'd that get there? You'd say, oh, gee, I don't know. That kind of looks like a nose and a forehead and a chin. You don't think some Indians a long time ago might have, you know, arranged things that way? Nah. And you and your friend would probably say, you know, it's interesting, but it's not enough to have a conclusion of design. But then suppose you were walking by another mountain and your friend asked you that same question. How did that mountain get to be like that? Well, it's clear that something like, you know, plate tectonics and volcanic activity, that might explain some parts of the mountain over here and over here, but it sure doesn't explain that. You need intelligent activity to explain the faces on the mountain. And what's more, you're certain that requires design as an explanation. So the point is that the evidence for design is quantitative. You can be less sure, you can be more sure. Okay, so that ends the first point of the argument, that design is deduced from the physical structure of a system. There's nothing mystical about it. You just look at it and say, look at that. You know, that is clearly intentionally arranged. The next point is that everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear to be designed. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what the theory of Darwin's theory of evolution was advanced to explain, the strong appearance of design in biology. And even the most dedicated Darwinists will agree on that point. For example, there's a man named Douglas Fatuma, who is a professor of evolutionary biology at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And in a recent interview with a website, a science website, he says that the reason that natural selection is important is that it's the central idea that explains design in nature. So we see design in nature. How do we explain that? And Professor Fatuma's response is that, well, it's natural selection. It must be natural selection. He goes on to say that natural selection is a very simple natural mechanism that explains the appearance of design in living things. Before Darwin, the adaptations and exquisite complexity of organisms were among the major arguments for the existence of such a designer. So organisms are exquisitely designed, he says, but we know it's just the appearance. We know it's natural selection. And then he goes on to say, the contemporary intelligent design movement is simply a repetition of the pre-Darwinian argument. And of course, it cannot be taken seriously as a scientific explanation, because, of course, it can't. Additionally, a man named Richard Dawkins, who's a professor of biology at Oxford University in England, in 20 years ago now, wrote a well-known book, The Blind Watchmaker. And on the first page of the first chapter of his book, he writes that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's what biology is. That is what it is. It's the study of things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. So we can perceive design in the structure of these things. How do we perceive this design? Do we perceive it because it looks so pretty, or because we have some love for living things? No, Dawkins says that we perceive it because we have a good sense of engineering sense of what it takes to accomplish a task. For example, he writes, "We may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose, such as flying, swimming, or seeing. Any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed, even poorly designed, for a purpose, and can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object." So again, even people who disagree with intelligent design agree that nature is just chock full of things that appear to have been designed and strongly appear to have been designed. But of course, Richard Dawkins does not think that biology, living things, were actually designed. He thinks that it was natural selection and random mutation that account for it. And he goes on, though, to say that natural selection is the blind watchmaker. Blind because it does not see ahead, does not plan consequences, has no purpose. Yet, the living results of natural selection overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design, as if by a master watchmaker, impress us with the illusion of design and planning. So he's saying that the appearance of design isn't just some vague intuition, it's overwhelming. It's way over towards the Mount Rushmore side of the scale. It is not towards the old man in the mountain side of the scale. Now, in his choice of title, The Blind Watchmaker, for his book, Richard Dawkins was intentionally echoing an argument put forward at the beginning of the 19th century, around the year 1800, by a man named William Paley, who was an Anglican clergyman and an amateur naturalist as well. And he wrote a well-known book called Natural Theology, which argued that the design in nature was real. And he made an analogy to a watch. He wrote that when we come to inspect the watch, he was saying that as you walk across a field, suppose you stumbled your foot across a watch, and you picked it up and you looked at the watch. When we inspect the watch, we perceive that its several parts are framed and put together for a purpose, that they are so formed and adjusted as to produce motion, and that motion so regulated as to point out the hour of the day. The inference, we think, is inevitable, that the watch must have had a maker. So Paley made that argument first, that we perceive the design in the purposeful arrangement of parts. Richard Dawkins says, yes, he appreciates the force of Paley's argument, but he says natural selection is the blind watchmaker. Well, since Paley wrote in the year 1800, and especially in the past 30 to 50 years, the similarities between living systems and mechanical objects like watches has grown enormously stronger, much, much stronger, especially at the cellular and molecular level, which was unknown to Paley. The more we have learned about life, especially at the foundational level of cells and molecules, the much, 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 much more strong Paley's analogy to a mechanical watch has become. For example, a couple years ago, the journal Cell put out a special review issue on the topic of macromolecular machines. And if you look in the lower left-hand corner, the artist has drawn something vaguely looking like Paley's watch. And inside the Science Journal, there are a number of papers which have titles such as The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines, Polymerases and the Replisome, Machines Within Machines, Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome, Motors, Clocks, Springs and Things. The editor of this for this special issue was a man named Bruce Alberts, who was until recently the president of the National Academy of Sciences. And he introduces it by saying about his graduate student days, "The chemistry that makes life possible is much more elaborate and sophisticated than anything we students had ever considered. Indeed, the entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines." And I should stress that the use of the word machine is not meant as an analogy. It is meant literally. These are not like machines. These are machines. And that is what Bruce Alberts emphasized too. He continued, "Why do we call the large protein assemblies that underlie cell function protein machines? Precisely because, like the machines invented by humans, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts." So they are machines. They have a purposeful arrangement of parts. Okay, so that was the second point of my argument for design in biology, that we perceive design. The first point is that we perceive design in the physical structure of a system. It's not some intuition. The second is that everyone, including people who strongly disagree with it, everyone agrees that aspects of biology exhibit this appearance of design. Nonetheless, neither Douglas Fatuma or Richard Dawkins or Bruce Alberts think that the apparent design in biology is in fact real. They think that Darwin's theory of random mutation and natural selection can account for the appearance of design. And so my third point is that that in fact there are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution. There are big problems with imagining how Darwinian processes could produce the sophisticated molecular machinery of the cell. And what are those obstacles? Well, Charles Darwin first pointed out what would be an obstacle to his theory in a section of the Origin of Species entitled Organs of Extreme Perfection and Complication, where he was talking about the eye. He wrote the following: "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," adding, "but I can find out no such case." In this passage, Darwin was emphasizing that his was a gradual theory. Natural selection had to improve things very slowly, in tiny steps, over long periods of time. Darwin knew that if things seemed to improve in big leaps over short periods of time, then it would look suspiciously like something other than random processes were involved. So Darwin always insisted on these very tiny steps to explain biology. Well, okay, let's take Darwin at his word. Let's ask ourselves, what sort of an organ or what sort of a system couldn't be put together, or looks like, or certainly doesn't looks like it can't be put together by numerous successive slight modifications. And the kind of a system that would be very resistant to a gradual theory like Darwin's is one which is irreducibly complex, or has the property of irreducible complexity. Now, irreducible complexity, it's a fancy phrase. You know, I made it up to make people think I'm smart. Hasn't worked yet. But it really stands for a simple concept. It just means you've got some system or machine or something that has a number of different parts, and all the parts work together with each other to produce an effect that the parts acting alone couldn't produce. Okay, again, as in much of this, it's a lot better to see illustrations than to hear verbal descriptions. So an example of an irreducibly complex system from our everyday world is shown on the next slide here. This is a mousetrap, an ordinary mousetrap that you might buy at the store. And it's got a number of different parts. It's got a wooden platform to which everything else is attached. It's got this tightly wound spring which has extended ends to press against the platform here and to press against this other metal part over here, which is called the hammer, which actually squashes the mouse. And you have to push the hammer over here, and that's got to be stabilized in position by something called the holding bar until the mouse comes along. And the end of the holding bar itself has to be inserted into something called the catch to stabilize it. Now, the mousetrap needs all of these parts to work. If you were missing the platform, if you were missing the spring or the hammer, you would not have a mousetrap that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. You would have a broken mousetrap. It would not work at all. So this is an example of what I mean by irreducible complexity. It needs all of its components to work. Now, things like this are big headaches for Darwin's theory. Because if you wanted to evolve something like a mousetrap by something like a Darwinian process, you know, how would you do that? You know, what would you start with? Would you start with, say, the wooden platform and, you know, hope to catch mice inefficiently? You know, maybe trip them or something like that. And then add, you know, maybe a second part. Maybe add the holding bar next. You know, maybe they would impale themselves as they tripped on there. No, you can't do it like that. Because irreducibly complex systems work only when pretty much everything is all set. So it's very difficult to see how you could put something like this together gradually. It only seems to work the way it's intended when everything's there. And once everything's there, the system is together and there's nothing left to explain. So irreducibly complex systems looked like they would be big challenges for Darwin's theory. Well, the question is, however, although mousetraps are very interesting, I think about them a lot, but nonetheless, the question is, are there any irreducibly complex biological systems or cellular systems or biochemical systems? And the answer is yes, there are tons of them. They're all over the place. This, I think, is the best visual example of such a system, and it's the only one I'll mention here tonight in the interests of time. And this is called the bacterial flagellum. The flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that bacterial cells use to swim. And it's got a lot of different parts. It's a rotary motor. It spins round and around and around, and this is the part that acts as the propeller, which, as it spins, pushes against the water in which a bacterium might find itself and therefore drives the cell forward. The propeller is attached to the drive shafts by something called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint, imparting the the rotary motion of the drive shaft to the rotary motion of the propeller. The drive shaft is attached to the rotary motor, which uses a flow of acid from outside of the cell to the inside of the cell to power the turning of the motor, much as water flowing over a dam hitting a turbine can power the turning of the turbine. The motor itself is kept stationary in the plane of the cell membrane by some proteins which act as a stator, kind of clamping it on to the membrane, much as you'd have bolts and screws clamping on an outboard motor to a boat as it turned and drove the boat forward. The drive shaft has to poke up through the bacterial membrane, and there are some proteins which act as bushing material to allow that to occur. And while this illustration, which is taken from a biochemistry textbook by Vogt and Vogt, while this makes it the flagellum look complex, let me assure you that this is just a cartoon version of the flagellum. And a lot of other things have to be present and working, which are not pictured in this illustration, in order for the system to work, such as how does this thing get assembled? There are many components that have to put it together and many other things as well. But nonetheless, I think the illustration is sufficient to show that the flagellum is irreducibly complex as well, like a mousetrap. If the flagellum were missing the hook region or the drive shaft or the stator, you would not have a flagellum that worked half as fast, or that spun half as fast as it used to, or a quarter as fast. It would not spin at all, or else it might not get built by the cell, because the cell also contains sophisticated feedback systems to let it know when the construction of this rather large structure is going well or whether it's going poorly. Because a lot of energy is spent in making this thing, and if it's not going well, the cell wants to stop it before it uses up too much energy for no good reason. So much like a mousetrap, the production of the flagellum by numerous successive slight modifications is extremely difficult to envision. And as a matter of fact, it's so difficult to envision that nobody has envisioned it. If you look in the science literature for serious Darwinian explanations for such a structure, you won't find them. Now, I like to show audiences this illustration of the flagellum because most people, when they see it, realize right away that this is a machine. It isn't analogous to a machine. It isn't like a machine. It is a real machine. And perhaps that can give us clues as to how to explain its origin. Okay, so that was my third point, that there are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution. You can't improve a lot of things. A lot of things can't be improved gradually in the step-by-step fashion that Darwin envisioned, things like the flagellum or a mousetrap, things that are irreducibly complex. But doesn't the science literature already contain explanations for things like this? Certainly, the structure of the flagellum has been known for decades, other molecular machines as well. And we've been assured that Darwinian processes can account for them. So doesn't the science literature contain explanations of these things? And the answer is surprisingly no. That in fact, Darwinian claims rest on imagination. And here are a couple of, my book, Darwin's Black Box, in which I go into more detail for these. Oh, thanks very much. This is for me to trip over when I'm going answering questions.
Part of the design.
Yeah. My book was published 10 years ago, Darwin's Black Box, in which I spell out these arguments that I'm kind of going over quickly tonight. And although this, when you think about it, this seems pretty obvious, nonetheless, this argument seems to have caught a lot of people by surprise, and so the book was pretty widely reviewed by by the public media, by science journals such as Nature, by Chronicle of Higher Education, Christianity Today, Philosophy of Science journals, and so on. And among these reviewers were many scientists, biochemists like myself, evolutionary biologists, molecular biologists. What have they had to say about these arguments? Well, they've had a lot of things to say, not all of them kind. But everybody agrees, or virtually everybody agrees, that these systems that I talk about, including the flagellum, are extremely complex and unexplained. For example, James Shreve, a science writer writing in the New York Times, said, "Mr. Behe may be right that given our current state of knowledge, good old Darwinian evolution cannot explain the origin of blood clotting or cellular transport." James Shapiro, who's a professor of biology at the University of Chicago, wrote, "There are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations." Jerry Coyne, another professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Chicago, wrote in Nature, which is the most prominent science journal in the world, "There is no doubt that the pathways described by Behe are dauntingly complex, and their evolution will be hard to unravel. We may forever be unable to envisage the first proto-pathways." And Andrew Pomankowski says something similar. "Pick up any biochemistry textbook, and you will find perhaps two or three references to evolution. Turn to one of these, and you will be lucky to find anything better than, quote, 'evolution selects the fittest molecules for their biological function,'" close quote. And he's a biologist at University College London. Oh, and that's my favorite one there at the bottom. Can you read it? I can make it a little bit bigger. If you But occasionally, most scientists will say that. They'll say, "Yeah, they're complex. No, we don't have explanations yet." But occasionally, you'll get people who say, "Oh, yeah, that's been explained. Sure, there are papers in the literature that explain that." And that's the reaction that a man named David Griffin got, who's a professor of the philosophy of religion at Claremont College in California. And he wrote about this in a book of his that he published a few years ago called Religion and Scientific Naturalism. And he wrote, "The response I have received from repeating Behe's claim about the evolutionary literature, which simply brings out the point being made implicitly by many others, is that I obviously have not read the right books. There are, I am assured, evolutionists who have described how the transitions in question could have occurred." And then he goes on to write, "When I ask in which books I can find these discussions, however, I either get no answer or else some titles that, upon examination, do not, in fact, contain the promised accounts. That such accounts exist seems to be something that is widely known, but I have yet to encounter anyone who knows where they exist." So in other words, it's an urban legend. "Yeah, we know that. Yeah, oh, I forgot where I read that. Yeah." But when you go looking for them, they are not there. I think the best, most succinct summary of the general reaction of the science community to the argument for intelligent design it occurred in a book called The Way of the Cell, which was published about 4 years ago. It was written by a man named Franklin Harold, who's an emeritus professor of biochemistry from Colorado State University. The Way of the Cell was published by Oxford University Press, a very prestigious academic publishing house. And his reaction was the following. He said, we should reject, as a matter of principle, the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity. And he cites my book. But we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations. So let's just take a minute to look up close at the two points that he's making in this passage. The first point, I'll take the points in reverse order. He says that, no, there are no detailed Darwinian accounts for these molecular machines, only a variety of wishful speculations, which are more colloquially known as just-so stories. You know, like the children's stories that were written by Rudyard Kipling more than 100 years ago, how the tiger got its stripes, how the rhinoceros got its horn, how the bacterium got its flagellum. You know, it's funny, but if you think about it a little longer, it's astonishing that a theory that commands the emotional allegiance of a very large fraction of the scientific community should be so utterly sterile at trying to explain the very foundation of life. And it makes you think that perhaps some other explanation might be called for. The second point that Franklin Harold made in that brief excerpt that I read is that he says we should reject, as a matter of principle, intelligent design. What principle? What principle is that? And surprisingly, he never says. He just writes that passage that I showed you, and then he goes on to talk about other things in his book. But what principle is it that forbids us to entertain the idea of design when you look at that illustration of the bacterial flagellum, and design is something that pops into your head right away? I mean, it's not hard to see. And as a matter of fact, Richard Dawkins and Douglas Fatuma see design in these systems, but we're forbidden. There's some principle that says we're not allowed to do that. Well, I don't know. He doesn't say what the principle is, but I think that he has in mind something like the following. And that is that intelligent design seems to point strongly beyond nature. It seems to have philosophical and even theological implications, and that makes some people uneasy. And they think that science should steer clear of theories that have such strong extra-scientific implications. Well, I understand what they're saying, but I disagree with them. When I was being trained as a student, as an up-and-coming scientist, we were always told that science is supposed to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Let other people worry about philosophical or other implications. We were just supposed to do the science. And I thought that was good advice then, and I continue to think it's good advice now. Okay, just seeing how much time I have here. I'll go for it. Occasionally, very occasionally, there have been people who said, not only, they don't say that we don't have an explanation. They'll say, we do have an explanation. And as a matter of fact, here's this paper in this literature that shows you're wrong, that shows this idea of irreducible complexity has been falsified experimentally. And that has happened once or twice. And I think the most instructive example concerns a system, the system that the body uses to clot blood. This is an electron micrograph of red blood cells which are caught in this kind of fisherman's web, which is a made up of a protein called fibrin, which is actually the material of the of blood clots that allows your blood to clot. And I had written about the blood clotting system in one chapter of Darwin's Black Box 10 years ago and showed that it's known that the blood clotting cascade is extremely complex. All of these little names here represents very, very complex proteins. And it's called a coagulation cascade because one material acts on the next, which acts on the next and on the next and so on. Down here is a material called fibrin. That's the material of the blood clot itself. And there's a lot of that precursor to that material in your blood. But it cannot exist in your blood as fibrin, or else all of your blood would be clotted. And you'd kind of be frozen here like this, and that would be sad. So it actually exists as an inactive precursor called fibrinogen. And it has to be activated in order for it to work. And it floats around in your bloodstream, and when it needs to be activated, another component chops off a piece of the fibrinogen, which exposes a sticky area on it, which allows it to stick specifically to other copies of fibrinogen and make this meshwork. And material that activates the fibrinogen is something called thrombin. But now, thrombin can't exist in its active form in the blood, or it would immediately activate the fibrinogen, and you'd be in the same pickle you would have been otherwise. So it exists as an inactive precursor called prothrombin. And it has to be activated turned into thrombin. And it's activated by another precursor, which is activated by another one, and so on. So this is called a cascade. And in Darwin's Black Box, I argued that this is irreducibly complex and therefore required design as well. Well, that's what I said, but a man named Russell Doolittle disagreed with me and wrote about his disagreement in an essay called A Delicate Balance, which is published by Boston Review, which is published by MIT, shortly after my book came out. Now, that wasn't really good for me, because Russell Doolittle is a very prominent scientist. He's a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, who has worked on the blood clotting system for the past 40 years. So he's not the kind of guy you want on the other side. And he said, not only was my argument wrong, there was experimental evidence to show that it was wrong, that this notion of irreducible complexity is incorrect. He wrote the following. He said, recently, the gene for plasminogen, which is kind of a chemical scissors, which it chops up the blood clot, gets rid of it once its job has been accomplished. Recently, the gene for plasminogen, there's a typo there, was knocked out of mice, means inactivated. Predictably, those mice had thrombotic complications because fibrin clots could not be cleared away. So without plasminogen, the clots stayed around and gunked up the circulatory system of the mice. Not long after that, the same workers knocked out the gene for fibrinogen in another line of mice. Now remember, fibrinogen is the precursor of the clot material itself. Again, predictably, these mice were ailing, although in this case, hemorrhage was the problem because they couldn't form clots. And what do you think happened when these two lines of mice were crossed? For all practical purposes, the mice lacking both genes were normal. Contrary to claims about irreducible complexity, the entire ensemble of proteins is not needed. Music and harmony can arise from a smaller orchestra. So he's saying, yeah, you know, you knock out one protein, the mice are in trouble. In another line of mice, you knock out a different protein, they're in trouble. But when you create a line of mice, you cross that line, they're missing both proteins, they're okay. So I guess the point would be that you don't have to go in steps of 20 proteins at a time. Maybe you can go in two steps of two proteins at a time, or or something like that. But he doesn't actually go on to spell out the rest of his argument, and we really don't have to wonder about it in too much detail, because it turns out that Russell Doolittle was mistaken. He misread the paper that he was referring to. The mice are not normal. They have a non-functional clotting system. They're in big trouble. This is the paper to which he was referring, that he had read. It's called Loss of Fibrinogen Rescues Mice from the Pleiotropic Effects of Plasminogen Deficiency. Now, Russell Doolittle saw the phrase rescues mice, and he thought that the mice were normal. It turns out they're not. In the abstract of the paper, the authors wrote, mice deficient in plasminogen and fibrinogen are phenotypically indistinguishable from fibrinogen deficient mice. Now, translated into English, that means that mice missing both proteins have all the problems that mice missing only fibrinogen have. Their blood doesn't clot. They hemorrhage. Female mice die during pregnancy. They are not promising evolutionary intermediates. They are not happy campers. And here's a table showing the symptoms of the various lines of mice. Lacking plasminogen, they have this suite of symptoms. Lacking fibrinogen, they have this suite of symptoms. And lacking both, they have been rescued from the symptoms of plasminogen deficiency, but only to suffer the symptoms of fibrinogen deficiency. Now, if you think about it for just a second, you'll easily see why these results are the way they are. Plasminogen is the protein that gets rid of blood clots once their job is done, and it's a garbage disposal. And if you can't get rid of blood clots, the clots gunk up your circulatory system and cause problems. If you lack fibrinogen, you can't form clots in the first place. So if you're lacking both, it doesn't matter that you're lacking plasminogen because you don't have any clots to get rid of. So it actually made sense for the researchers to do this experiment because they wanted to know if plasminogen had any other roles in the mice other than just in blood clotting. So if some symptom had not been relieved by knocking out the fibrinogen, then that would indicate it was doing something else other than helping with blood clotting. But nonetheless, the point is that the mice are not normal at all. As a matter of fact, the same group of workers have gone on to look to knock out other components of the blood clotting cascade, including prothrombin and something called tissue factor. And in each case, the result is hemorrhage and death. The mice do not have a functioning clotting system, which is exactly what you would predict if the clotting cascade were, in fact, irreducibly complex, as I had argued. So, what is to be concluded from Professor Doolittle's mistake? It's not that he misread a paper. Anybody can misread a paper. You know, scientists are not well known for the clarity of their prose. When I went back to read it after he cited it, it took me a while to figure out what the heck these guys were talking about. No, the point is this. It's that Russell Doolittle knows more about the clotting cascade, about the genes for the clotting factors, about the proteins themselves, than anybody else on Earth. And yet, I think you can tell from his mistakenly pointing to that cell paper that Russell Doolittle does not know how Darwinian processes could have produced something as complex as the blood clotting cascade. And if Russell Doolittle does not know, nobody knows. Nobody at all knows. And that actually is a real important point to keep in mind, because this is such an emotional topic that a lot of people will tell you, yes, they do know, or science knows, or it is known. And they will look you in the eye, and they will say with utter certitude that that's the case. And that's such an important point that I'm going to spend a minute or two exactly making that point. For example, a couple years after Russell Doolittle's essay, a man named Michael Ruse wrote an essay called Answering the Creationist, Where They Go Wrong and What They're Afraid Of, in a magazine called Free Inquiry. Now, Michael Ruse is a well-known philosopher of biology, a student of Darwin, who has written perhaps 15 books on Darwin, his life, his philosophy, and so on. And in his essay, he wrote the following. He said, for example, Behe is a real scientist, but this case for the impossibility of a small-step natural origin of biological complexity has been trampled upon contemptuously by the scientists working in the field. They think his grasp of the pertinent science is weak, and his knowledge of the literature curiously, although conveniently, outdated. For example, far from the evolution of clotting being a mystery, the past three decades of work by Russell Doolittle and others has thrown significant light on the ways in which clotting came into being. More than this, it can be shown that the clotting mechanism does not have to be a one-step phenomenon with everything already in place and functioning. One step in the cascade involves fibrinogen required for clotting, and another, plaminogen, required for clearing clots away. And he goes on to quote exactly that passage from Russell Doolittle's essay that I had on the previous slide. So here is an academic, a well-known academic, who has studied Darwin all his life and is utterly certain that he is correct and is relying for his certitude on somebody who's demonstrably wrong. Not only that, you know, this is a philosopher, somebody who's supposed to, you know, kind of step back and look at the arguments, but so many people are so utterly certain that Darwinian evolution is correct that they don't even have to go back and read what the argument is about. And plaminogen, there's a typo. It's the same typo that was in Russell Doolittle's essay. With Russell Doolittle, it's a typo. With Michael Ruse, he copied Russell Doolittle's argument. He relied exclusively on Doolittle's argument. He was so certain that he had to be correct. So the point is that a lot of people will tell you with great certainty, even you know, distinguished people, that science has answers for this, and it's not correct. One more example for that, just to drive the point home, you know, Michael Ruse is a philosopher, and, you know, what do they know anyway? But Neil Green, that's a joke, in case there's any philosophers around. But Neil Green's man, you know, he's a scientist, and they know everything. He's a professor of pathology at Case Western Reserve University. And a couple years ago, he wrote an article called Not So Intelligent Design, another fan, in a journal called The Scientist. And he had the following to say. The design advocates also ignore the accumulating examples of the reducibility of biological systems. As Russell Doolittle has noted in commenting on the writings of one ID advocate, who shall remain nameless, mice genetically altered so that they lack either thrombin or fibrinogen have the expected abnormal hemostatic phenotypes. However, when the separate knockout mice are bred, the double knockouts apparently have normal hemostasis. Reducible complexity after all, at least in the laboratory. Exactly the same argument as Russell Doolittle's, with one exception. It's plasminogen and fibrinogen, not thrombin and fibrinogen. Now here's a guy, a scientist, who could have gone back and read the papers that were being argued about, but clearly he was so confident that Russell Doolittle was correct that he didn't even feel the need to do that. Greenspan goes on to say with unintended irony, these results cast doubt on the claim by proponents of intelligent design that they know which systems exhibit irreducible complexity and which do not. But now, since the results are actually the exact opposite of what Neil Greenspan thought, the shoe is on the other foot. This shows that it is Darwinists who have great trouble in recognizing difficulties for their theory, and they need other people to point those out to them. Okay, so this makes the point that the grand Darwinian claims that Darwinian processes can explain the very complex structures of life rest on undisciplined imagination. Okay, undisciplined, not grounded in enough reality, not grounded in facts. And the conclusion then is that the bottom line is that we have strong evidence for design and very little evidence for Darwinism. Now, you might say to yourself, remind me again, what was that strong evidence for design? And it's this. The living results overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design, as if by a master watchmaker, impress us with the illusion of design and planning. We apprehend design in the purposeful arrangement of parts. Biology is chock full of the purposeful arrangement of parts. Now, what sort of an argument is this? What sort of an argument is this that we conclude design from the purposeful arrangement of parts? Well, it's the following kind of argument. What is that? If it looks like a duck, and it walks and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And this is actually kind of a colloquial expression for a type of argument that that philosophers have a more formal name for. There are two kinds of arguments, at least. There's deductive argument, and then there's an... Sorry. An inductive argument. Whenever we see the same cause responsible for the same results over and over and over again, we conclude that the cause is necessary for the results. Well, yeah, inductive arguments. Yeah, that's good for philosophy, but we're talking science here. Well, if you look a little further, you can see, for example, the Encyclopedia Britannica says, when a person uses a number of established facts to draw a general conclusion, he uses inductive reasoning. This is the kind of logic normally used in the sciences. This is not some special argument. This is how we make scientific conclusions. Okay, so one more time for the road. Design is not some mystical conclusion. We see it all the time. We conclude it from the physical structure of a system. Everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear designed. There are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution. Darwinian claims rest on imagination. And so we have that strong evidence of design. The evidence is what everybody's trying to explain, the strong appearance of design, and little evidence for Darwinism. Okay, now, aside from the criticisms that I talked about in this discussion tonight, there have been many, many other criticisms as well leveled at intelligent design. And I've responded to a number of the more prominent criticisms in a couple of book chapters, a couple of articles in Philosophy of Science journals, but most accessibly, at this place on the web. So anybody who's interested in the nitty-gritty of this back and forth on the topic of intelligent design can visit here. Now, these are my responses to criticisms. If you want the original criticisms themselves, they're generally easy to find. They're they're generally on the web too. You go into any search engine, type in my name plus any common swear word, and you'll get tons of hits. Okay. Thanks very much for your attention.